David Graham, editor of Science's free online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science stories. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, we're going to talk about how eating fish can make you smarter, why border collies are good herders, and why Rottweilers are so bold. And we'll look at a study that's trying to solve the gay paradox.
Well, let's start with eating fish makes you smarter. What is it about the nutritional content of fish that does that?
Well, Rob, fish, as you may know, are very high in what's called omega-3 fatty acids. And researchers have speculated for a while that there is a positive benefit of eating omega-3s. And this new study adds to that evidence, especially for pregnant women and young girls.
Well, why them in particular?
Well, the first evidence for this particular group actually came a couple years ago when a team of researchers noticed that women who stored more fat on their hips versus on their waist tended to have higher cognitive test scores, and their children did as well. And what's significant about this fat placement is there tends to be more omega-3 in these areas around the hips versus in the fat around the waist. So that was the first clue. And the same team decided to look at this a little more closely. And what they did was they analyzed about 4,000 girls and boys that have participated in a national study conducted in the U.S. just to measure nutrition levels among young kids. And then they factored out all of these other extraneous factors like education and maybe if the kids lived in a polluted environment. And what they found was when they took all this other stuff away, girls that ate more omega-3 fatty acids like those found in fish scored higher on IQ tests and other types of cognitive tests than girls that didn't eat as many omega-3 fatty acids.
Now by higher, what's the overall effect here?
Well, it's higher, but the overall effect is quite small. The researchers speculate that eating omega-3s only counts for about a 1% difference. And that may not seem like much, but that's the same difference in cognitive tests that is also attributed to things like higher levels of lead in the environment.
Being a 1% decrease.
And speaking of decreases, the researchers also found that omega-6 fatty acids, which are more likely to be found in soy and corn oils, actually had the opposite effect of omega-3. Girls that ate an abundance of these tended to do slightly worse on these cognitive and IQ tests.
Now, that's the majority of the U.S. diet anyway, right? Corn and soy?
Well, that's the problem. That's what some experts are saying. They're saying because so much of our diet, especially recently, is very rich in these omega-6 fatty acids, that government officials might want to think about when they're crafting dietary guidelines for young girls and also for pregnant women to tell them to emphasize omega-3s more in their diet.
Well, from fatty acids that make girls smarter to genes that make dogs better herders. Are these whole stretches of genes, or are we talking about just a little tiny change?
Well, Rob, what we're talking about are little tiny changes. In fact, just a single base pair change in an entire stretch of DNA. And these little changes are what biologists call single nucleotide polymorphisms. And sometimes these differences can be tied to a whole host of diseases in humans, increased risk of, say, stroke or schizophrenia or things like that. And now researchers are looking at them in dogs to see, do these little changes add up to anything in terms of why certain breeds of dogs are different than others in terms of the behaviors they have or even how big or hairy they are.
Okay, so what are some of these changes? You mentioned better herding. I always thought of this as kind of an instinctual thing.
Right, and that's why this study is so significant. These behaviors that we thought could be chalked up to training or environment seem to be genetically based. And so what this group of researchers did was they looked at about 150 breeds of dogs, and they looked for these single nucleotide polymorphisms. And they were finding things in terms of why, say, border collies are better herders, because they found all border collies tend to have the same little change on a specific gene.
Compared to
another animal, say, like a Rottweiler, which may not be seen as a good herder and didn't have this genetic change. And the places they were finding these little changes were significant. For example, they found one of these little changes in a gene called SMAD4. And this is a gene that controls for cell growth. And when there was that little change in the gene, that seemed to determine which dogs were heavier than others.
You said seems to determine. Is it this the single nucleotide polymorphism change, or are there a number of different factors?
Well, Rob, the complicated thing here is you're never really going to find that one change that explains an entire behavior. These things are very complicated. And so likely it's going to be tied to a bunch of different genetic changes.
Well, it's always interesting to look at the genetics of another species. But is this research going to add any to our understanding of our own genetic code?
That's a good question, Robin. Clearly, that's the long-term goal here. I mean, there are immediate applications for dogs themselves because breeders are always interested in how can they create dogs with specific traits. But for humans, there's so many behaviors that we have that we don't understand, like schizophrenia, that if we find genes that are related to certain behaviors in dogs, it may tell us more about ourselves. For example, just speaking of schizophrenia, that genetic variation I told you about that was linked to border collies being able to herd better has also been tied to a variation in humans that's associated with schizophrenia. So we're already starting to make these small links between dog genetics and human genetics.
Well, from the differences in behavior that are tied to a dog's genes to the differences of behavior between straight and homosexuals, let's start off with talking about what is the gay paradox.
Well, Rob, studies seem to indicate that there are so-called gay genes, genes that might contribute to making somebody homosexual. But the paradox is, how are these genes surviving from generation to generation if gay people have significantly fewer children than heterosexuals do?
What's the evidence that there even is this gay gene?
Well, over the past two decades, there have been a few studies indicating that there are gay genes. Studies have shown that, for example, that homosexuality tends to run in families. Siblings and relatives of homosexuals are more likely to be homosexual themselves. And also studies have shown that male homosexuals have more gay male relatives on their maternal lines than on their paternal lines. And this may indicate that if there is a gay gene, it might be on the X chromosome because women have two X chromosomes and men only have one.
So if it's on the X chromosome, then it transfers differently in women than in men.
Exactly. And another study showed that women who are related to gay men tend to have more children than women that aren't, about 2.7 children versus 2.3 children. And that's actually a pretty significant difference. And that lends credence not only to the idea that there may be a homosexuality gene or genes, but that it's somehow linked to the X chromosome and that it somehow confers a benefit to women that aren't homosexual.
The benefit being that they have more children.
Exactly.
What about the gene that is implicated in women being homosexuals?
That's a good question, Rob. And I think this study is mainly dealing with genes that would confer homosexuality to men. But to see just how these genes might be passed on, a group of researchers created this mathematical formula where they plugged in a bunch of different variables, assuming different numbers of gay genes and gay genes being on different chromosomes and different ways they could be passed on from parents to offspring. And the model they came up with that fit the findings that are out there the best was this idea that there are at least two gay genes. One is on the X chromosome and one is on what's called an autosomal or non-sex chromosome. And the second idea is that these genes may increase how attracted both men and women are to men. So in other words, if you're a guy and you have these genes, you may be more likely to be attracted to other guys, which would sort of be a bad thing in terms of passing on these genes. But if you're a woman and you inherit these genes, you may be even more attracted to men. And that being the case, you're statistically more likely to have more children. So that explains the paradox by showing that even though homosexual men and women may have a harder time passing on these genes, when their relatives get these genes, it may actually make them more likely to pass on these genes. So it's a way to keep these genes going in the population, even if the homosexual men and women that have them aren't directly passing them on themselves.
With more studies presumably to be done on both, but in particular in finding analogs of these genes among women who are homosexual.
Yeah, I would assume that's so.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now?
Well, Rob, we're looking into stories about how extreme weather events can unleash a perfect storm of infectious diseases, how HIV first came to humans, and finally, how grief might actually activate the pleasure centers of the brain. So be sure to check out the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science stories at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.